Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Today, another special episode for the Spring Fund Drive. We're going to be talking with NPR reporter Kirk Siegler. Kirk Siegler is a national correspondent for NPR News. As a roving reporter, he covers the western U.S. with an emphasis on rural issues, water, and the effects of climate change on smaller communities and former natural resource-dependent towns. Very busy reporter. He's taking a bit of time with us today. So, Kirk Siegler, thank you so much.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm sure you got a bunch you're reporting on, so we appreciate you taking just a bit of time here during our fun drive. So we'll ask you to give your best pitch later in the program here. So your background, Kirk, did you grow up in Montana? I think you went to school in Montana.
I went to school at the University of Colorado, actually.
Oh, you did?
I did grow up in Montana, in Missoula, or just outside Missoula, actually, which is sort of an interesting location for a myriad of reasons, but it somehow got me started early into an early, if you will, nerdy interest in like forest management issues, because Missoula was the first satellite office for the U.S. Forest Service outside of Washington, D.C. So there's a long, long presence there and a big smoke jumper base as well. So I kind of grew up next to a historic ranger station and grew up right around the woods. And that sort of, I like to think back on it today as thinking like, that sort of got me interested in some of the stuff I cover today, whether I knew it or not at the time.
And we're used to you know, covering Western issues, of course, rural America as well, kind of wide-ranging, and a variety of things. I was reading your bio, Kirk. I'd never encountered this part, if you can believe Wikipedia, but it's also on the NPR site. You were a waiter in Australia for a while?
If you can believe Wikipedia, man, it's totally fact-checked. Unlike a lot of things on the internet, right, today?
Yeah.
Yeah, I did move there after college as part of a globe trekking endeavor. I applied for a work visa and everything, and had planned to move to Australia and try to get enough money there to travel around the world from there. And went through all the steps and had that work visa in hand, and then became a waiter, and nobody ever asked to see my work visa.
Okay.
It was all under the table.
No, so why Australia?
Great question. Never thought of that. I think it always sort of held a little mystery to me, and it seemed far away. When I got there, it sort of felt like an upside-down California or an upside down UK, you know. It sort of looks like California. The people talk a little funny. I hope I'm not offending anybody. I'm obviously saying this all in glib, but yeah, it was a great time. And in fact, weirdly, coincidentally, some of my family later would move there. So I've traveled back and forth there quite a bit and even looked at some of the wildfire crisis there as well, as it is applicable to California in the West too.
Yeah, certainly wildfires there as well. So went to school in Colorado, got into, how'd you get into reporting?
I had always wanted to be a sports broadcaster. In fact, in about 45 minutes, I'll have another screen open. Don't tell anybody, except I just revealed this watching March Madness. I always wanted to be a sports broadcaster. And in high school, my high school football team was really good. And one of the local radio stations would broadcast the games. And I approached the guys and they were like, oh, you can be the sideline reporter. And then they'd sometimes just hand me the mic at halftime while they went and smoked cigarettes. And I had to do the entire halftime show. So I got into broadcasting that way. And I always sort of thought I was going into or interested in going into sports or maybe TV or maybe even weather. And then I did get a degree in journalism. I think it's most important to get a degree of some sort if possible. I don't know that journalism specifically is necessary, but I did get one in journalism. And after said stint in Australia and Africa and a couple other countries, I did what many people did at the time and probably still do who have the means to travel. They end up back at their parents' house. And I walked into the NPR affiliate in Missoula, Montana, and said, hey, I have a journalism degree. And then eventually I got kind of interested in it. They let me do some stories and reporting, and I really kind of got the bug. And then I got a job there full time shortly after, covering the state legislature, as was my first sort of cub reporting job, and thrown right into the fire, and covering politics initially and getting to roam around the state as well. Sort of got the bug, and you know, I still do it some 20 years later. So it's still a blast. It's challenging. It's getting more challenging by the minute, by the second sometimes. But yeah, that's the I like to say sometimes that I got into it in quasi accident. I wasn't totally sure I was going to go into it, although I knew I wanted to do broadcast of some sort.
Mm-hmm. So just parenthetically, you mentioned you're going to watch the Final Four. You're going to watch the NCAA. Who are your Final Four teams?
You know what? I have like three or four brackets.
Oh, you do? Yeah. What a lot of people do. Yeah. Yeah.
Houston, Duke, yeah. Iowa State, and St. John's, actually.
All right.
Not having it right in front of me. That's pretty good that I remembered that.
Yeah. So. That's good. That's good. Yeah. We'll see how you do. Yeah. You mentioned challenges getting more challenging by the time. What are some of the top challenges
I think probably the listeners won't be surprised. It is a very polarizing time. Getting people to be willing to speak to you and open up to a national reporter in particular seems to be getting more challenging. That said, people on the whole are still up for it. But this moment right now, in the first 100 days of the Trump administration, Elon Musk, some people are afraid to talk. Some people who supported them are afraid to talk, or support them are afraid to talk, or they have, you know, preconceived notions of what NPR is. I mean, just the other day I was in North Dakota reporting a story about tariffs, and, you know, I knew that people weren't going to want to talk politics, but one guy that I interviewed, I ended up interviewing, and he ended up giving me a thoughtful interview initially, you know, told me, well, I might talk to you, but, you know, NPR is not going to like what I hear or what I'm about to say, as if to say that NPR and other mainstream media are liberal. We won't go into that debate. We probably don't have enough time to talk and parse that one. But I use that as an example because I have to then say, well, my stories are all over the internet. I'd invite you to look at what I do. I try my best. Of course, we all have our own biases coming into things, but I try to do my best to tell that story or tell your story and get your story out there and all the facts out there in a way that informs our listeners and increasingly our readers online. But it is difficult, you know, in this politically polarized moment. People have preconceived notions. I would, as an asterisk or an addendum to that, I would say that most people still want to talk and kind of appreciate having someone come listen to them, especially in rural places that are long sort of, I'm using air quotes on the radio here with my fingers, forgotten. And people, you know, do still want to talk. And like I said, the gentleman in question who made that kind of half joke to me then opened up and we had a good conversation. And hopefully, possibly, he heard the story and was able to see, oh, that guy's still out there. There's still some reporters out there in public radio, in particular in public media, that are still trying to get all sides and tell the story. But I'm also often sometimes the first reporter or journalist many people in smaller towns have ever met. I don't know what kind of first impression I make, but they don't necessarily know what to expect. And maybe their image of, you know, who or what a reporter is and does is based on, you know, some false notions. And then it's our job to sort of, I guess, day to day, person to person, restore some of the trust. But yes, it's a difficult time right now.
Yeah, that is hopeful. And, you know, maybe we non-reporters can take some cues from that, right? If you stay unconnected and have your assumptions, you can't break the assumptions down until you meet each other and talk to each other, right? Now, you're under the guise of reporting, you're with your job, but I guess the rest of us can just, you know, reach out to each other.
Good luck.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Right. I do. Yeah, no, but I think it's still possible. And in fact, a colleague of mine and I, Debbie Elliott, who's sort of my regional counterpart, NPR's national desk where I report on. has kind of moved away from more regional correspondence and into more specialty beats. However, Debbie and I are still kind of very focused mostly on our regions these days, with some sprinkling in of rural. But we are doing a series where we're spending time in different communities across the country, in particular the Midwestern US, talking to people about what their hopes are, what their anxieties are for the future in the coming months now that there's a new administration. Things feel like they're moving pretty fast. Some might even say quite chaotic, if erratic. And we're out trying to talk to people on the ground to see what they think. And, you know, early on, she's been reporting in Mississippi so far, and myself in North Dakota. I'm about to go to New Mexico. You know, there is still a middle ground, and there's still a lot of people still in the middle, to your point. Now, whether or not those people are heard as much in the national political discourse is a totally other bigger question, but there are still people out there, and even people on the right or people on the left, in particular in this last case when I was in North Dakota reporting on tariffs facing farmers, everyone will say, like, well, God, I'm just so tired of how polarizing it is. So I do think there's still some, you know, chance that the polarization will go down, at least as I see it.
Mm-hmm. Are you seeing any other themes emerge as you're talking to people on the ground, you know, hopes and dreams and worries and fears?
A lot of fear right now. If we zero in on North Dakota and farming in particular, it's a $41 billion agricultural economy, in North Dakota. I dare say where I'm talking to you from, or where you guys are in northern Utah, a huge dairy industry, some of which depends on exports. So I can't imagine that. I have not been to the Cache Valley in a year or more, I guess, but I would assume there is also some economic anxiety there over tariffs, as American farmers have, you know, really come to rely on exports. They also rely a lot on imports. In particular, fertilizer from Canada. And so in North Dakota in particular, you know, I think I detected, now this is only my experience, one snapshot in time, I detected a little bit of, maybe this isn't quite what we thought it was going to be with the incoming administration, just because of the perception that it's so erratic, the way things are changing and the way this tariff will be levied and then not. And then, you know, farmers in particular, not to lump them all together, but many American farmers are still reeling from the last trade war in 2018 in China. And so I did hear a lot of anxiety, and it's not just the tariffs, it's the inflation driving up prices for everything. It's the crop prices being low. It's the uncertainty about whether or not the U.S. government will support them in ways that have, you know, helped them mitigate. You know, some say subsidies, some say aid, but they are growing our food, right? So call it what you want. But I think there's a lot of anxiety about whether this administration, as it appears to be slashing federal agencies left and right, will be around to pump in money if things get even worse for American farmers. So then on the other hand, you talk to some cattle ranchers and they think things are going okay, because the American cattle herd, mostly due to hard times in recent years, is at its lowest since the 50s. And so beef prices are really high. So I guess I'm cautioning myself, everyone needs an editor, you know, to say that it's not, you know, one uniform thing across farm country. But in a state like North Dakota, for instance, where one in five jobs are tied to agriculture, there's a lot of anxiety and uncertainty over the future right now. Just the unknowns, I think.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, we're talking with NPR correspondent Kirk Siegler. He's joining us for a bit here during our fun drive. And Kirk, that's what I want to talk about next, just for a couple of minutes, the need to support this kind of journalism. You hear Kirk's reports and you appreciate those. That's not free. It takes money to support those. The good news is you don't have to bear that entire cost. Just kick in at $10 a month or at a level that's good for you and go to upr.org, upr.org, and give your support. Kirk, I've talked to you before, I think, about this on air and off air. Maybe you can reinforce that. It's not free. In fact, it's a bit expensive to send a Kirk Siegler out there.
Right. Well, we do try to be and are, as you know, fiscally responsible with your member dollars as possible. But like to your point, Tom, it's not cheap. It's not cheap to go to North Dakota, even though it's two states over from me, from where I live. You know, sometimes editors on the East Coast think like, well, you just, you know, can you just drive over there? And like, sure, it's 24 hours. You know, it's a big country out here, right? So I'm just off the top of my head. That trip probably cost $2,000 to $3,000 just in, you know, airlines, three nights hotel, rental car, gas, and food. And, you know, that's cheap. If you think about what it costs to send reporters into the Middle East right now or other countries, or even sometimes in our own country during natural disasters when the security or safety issues are much higher. I wasn't particularly fortunately facing a lot of that, but it does cost money to get these stories. And we try to do it. We try to spend enough time on the ground in these communities to really get the actual story. So that then also takes a few days. For instance, I have been to North Dakota farm country quite a bit. And so I maybe didn't need to spend as much time as I would have liked or as the other person might coming in from, say, the East Coast. But it still takes a couple days to get a big story like that on the air. For instance, in this case, it was a 7-minute feature that aired last week on NPR's Morning Edition. But yeah, that all costs money. And we get a lot of bang for our buck, too. For instance, I'm trying to plan my next story, which will probably take me to New Mexico and oil and gas country. To look at how the administration's new push to drill for oil is. That'll probably cost about as much, but we're still talking tariffs. And when I hang up with you, I will then go on the NPR Politics podcast to talk about tariffs and anxiety in farm country and play some of the interviews that I conducted, some of which were already on the air and some didn't make it to the air in that last feature. So we do, you know, spend member dollars wisely, but it is your member dollars that is literally filling the gas tank to enable me to drive from Fargo in whatever it is, my Hyundai, my Nissan Sentra. I was watching very closely to make sure there wasn't a blizzard in North Dakota. But, you know, all that costs money and it does take a lot of time. I probably drove 4 or 5 hours around eastern North Dakota, maybe 6 actually, over the course of about 48 hours. So, yes, it directly funds that and also some of the behind-the-scenes work, production help, and editing help as well.
So support great work like the work that Kirk Siegler does by going to upr.org, upr.org today. Make that donation in whatever amount, and we'll connect you up with thank you gifts such as our new UPR art mug. That's for a pledge of $10 a month. This access to information isn't just a convenience, it's a cornerstone of our democracy. And when everyone has the opportunity to stay informed, we all benefit. So our society becomes more engaged, more understanding, better equipped to face the challenges of our times. But as we've been saying, it's not free. And we all spread the cost and bear that as a community. Plus, you're helping others who maybe can't afford to give right now. So we help you give right now, upr.org, upr.org. And again, Kirk Siegler's with us for another 10 minutes or so. I want to talk about the wildfires in Los Angeles. You've covered a lot of, you know, the Paradise Fire, the Camp Fire, right? Los Angeles just now, Maui. First of all, I wanted to have you take us behind the scenes. When did you first become aware of these fires in L.A. were going to be much more serious than kind of usual?
Well, we were watching them, my editor and I, and another editor on the West Coast, you know, because actually just 3 weeks prior, or 2 or 3 weeks prior, there had been another close call, still a wildfire in Malibu. So I'm sitting here in Boise and watching local news, KCAL 9 in Los Angeles, watching the feeds and trying to decide whether this was going to be as bad as it kind of looked with that windstorm. So about a couple hours into it that afternoon, I believe it was the Tuesday afternoon, it was looking pretty bad. And so we don't have as many colleagues as we'd like right now in Southern California in particular as a result of budget constraints, which I don't need to go into. But I used to be based in Southern California, and I'm based in Boise right now in part because of my beat covering wildfires, not just the West, but they're sort of woven together. And Boise is the headquarters of the National Interagency Fire Center, which is sort of the pulse, the nerve vein of the American firefighting apparatus. So we're watching everything from here and thinking, okay, this may be bad. So I, you know, said I can get on a 6:30 a.m. flight to LAX in the morning, and we can watch it tonight and make sure and that it's, you know, it's looking as bad as it is. And of course, you know, at 4:30 in the morning on the next day, it was clear, like, get on the plane, get down there. And I guess because I know the area and I have a lot of experience covering wildfires, I'm not trying to pat myself on the back by any means, but I was one of the first NPR staffers into the fire zone, despite living in Idaho. It's not that far of a flight down to Los Angeles, but we also got to landing at LAX, which is usually you don't land over the ocean because of the wind pattern, but because we were flying into the Santa Ana winds, flew right over that Palisades fire. And I have to say, it's kind of this like sense of dread, like, here we go again. You know, it looked to me like paradise, or it looked to me like Maui, the Lahaina fire. And going in there within about an hour, California is a unique state to cover wildfires in due to the press access, I believe, from an old court challenge long ago. So unlike Utah, Idaho, any other Western state that I can think of, where you to get into a wildfire, you usually have to have an escort with a federal agency. In California, you just show your press badge, and ideally you have safety gear on, PPE, Nomex, and all of that. But even if you don't, sometimes you can still get through the police roadblocks. So I knew that from covering countless California wildfires. And so I immediately drove up PCH into the Palisades fire because it was really only about a 15-minute drive from LAX because there was no traffic on any of the freeways. And so got in there pretty quickly. Now, I have a mantra, like, we're only radio. We don't need to get that close to the flames to put ourselves in danger. But it was quite an experience. And each wildfire, I think, you know, I sometimes approach these as like, oh, you know, it's a natural disaster. We can debate about how natural these are at this point. But it, unlike some of the other tragedies we have to cover, I hate to create a, you know, hierarchy, but you think, okay, so it's not maybe as bad as a mass shooting or something. You know, this is something that's kind of not that preventable. But each time I go into these wildfires, they seem to be getting worse, or at least that's my perception. And this one was especially difficult to cover, I would share, because, you know, you asked from behind the scenes, these are areas that I, you know, have friends in, constantly recreated in, you know, for years when I lived in Southern California. So in some sense that benefited me because I'm like, oh, that's a good road biking route right there. I can park right there and put my car facing the other direction because I know where this road goes out and I can go up on foot for a few minutes to check out some of the fire and not be in too much danger. I also had a friend who was very nervous about his apartment that many of my friends and I have spent time in and, you know, had a lot of dinner parties in. And I went and checked on it for him and FaceTimed him from there to say, hey, it's okay. So this, you know, each of these fires is different, but they seem to be getting worse. And this one behind the scenes was really interesting, tricky, and kind of sad to cover because it was in an area that, you know, adjacent to where I spent a good chunk of my, career living.
I want to just have about 2 or 3 minutes left. I want to just take one aspect of your reporting on the fires. It really has stood out to me, which is a question of, you know, the campfire, for example. And I understand not the entire town of Paradise hasn't come back, right? It's the Maui fires and here the LA fires. The question of, should government encourage people to go back? Should they make it harder? Should they make it easier? Talk a little bit about that, this whole question of should people even go back to some of those areas?
Yeah, this is the perennial tension, particularly in California. But across the country, you know, we can have that discussion and that debate, but we have to remember that we are talking about people's lives and people's property. And this country values or puts a high value on private property values. So in some sense, governments are kind of limited, and communities are kind of limited about trying to decide whether or not places should be rebuilt. Paradise is an example where we came in. I spent a number of months after the campfire trying to get at that question. And I was often, the response was often and valid, like, well, should people live in Los Angeles because they know there's earthquakes there all the time? Or should we move down into the Central Valley away from the foothills, the forested foothills of the Sierra, and down by the Sacramento River, which quite a bit often catastrophically floods? There's a volcano, Mount Shasta, by the way, right there. The question being, where can you live without risk? So I think the debate or the discussion has shifted. I've watched over the last few years is, you know, some people are just not going to rebuild because of the trauma and among other things. But when we get whole neighborhoods, like in the case of Los Angeles, 100-year-old neighborhoods, not exactly the wildland urban interface that we think of, even though Los Angeles is sort of built all around the wildland and urban interface, not unlike Salt Lake City. and I don't mean to, you know, chuckle about that, but these are places that were very established at a time when we didn't have quite as much of a wildfire risk. And I think the discussion is going to be, and is more, how do we, if we are going to rebuild, because we're not going to prevent people from rebuilding, just imagine it's your home, you know, you've lived, it's your identity. You want to rebuild if you can, or if you have the economic or emotional wherewithal to do it. It's more about how do we rebuild in a way that is more resilient and safe. So I've really been interested watching that progress quite a bit. Paradise, California is probably, I hope I'm not sounding too hyperbolic here, is probably one of the safer places to live right now in the foothills of the Sierra Nevada, because so many trees have been cleared out. The power lines that, let's face it, are igniting most of these wildfires that are turning deadly these days, the actual culprit, along with climate and forest conditions, they're buried in Paradise. And among other, you know, and other things, there are more parks, there are more open spaces. The city is being redesigned. Now it's more expensive than it was, and that's another whole challenge and issue. But I think you're going to see that. It's also difficult to compare any of these places. Los Angeles is the second largest city in the U.S. It's also one of the most expensive cities in the world. Rebuilding there is going to be different than, say, Paradise or Lahaina. The other two places are quite remote. They're going to have their own challenges getting labor and building supplies with inflation going up. So, yeah, these are all of which to say, these are interesting and very complicated issues and questions that honestly are just going to keep getting worse and worse, I hate to say, or perhaps more prevalent until we really figure out how to rebuild smart or even make our communities that are already there. I don't think you're going to get a situation where you're picking up and moving a lot of people, because where would they go, as I've said? So it's about making places as wildfire resistant or resilient as possible. And I think you were seeing that all across the West, actually. And maybe it's not getting as much attention in the news as it should, because, you know, when the fire breaks out, that's what everybody's covering. But there are good things going on behind the scenes, and a lot of smart people asking a lot of smart questions in places like LA, Northern California, Hawaii, Utah, Colorado, on what we should be doing in the future. I list a bunch of places there that have had, you know, extraordinary urban wildfires recently.
Well, we've been talking with Kirk Siegler. He is a national correspondent for NPR News, and you hear his reports regularly on Utah Public Radio. Kirk Siegler, I guess, next on to, sounds like, New Mexico.
Yes, I think, or potentially, there's always an asterisk, potentially Wyoming, but we're spending, I'm going to head out to a place where there's a lot of oil and gas drilling. Hey, maybe northeastern Utah as well.
That's right.
Anything's on the table for the next couple of weeks, but we're going to look at places where there's been boom or boom and bust with drilling on federal public land. Now that the administration is pushing this fast tracking of more drilling, I think the question will become, and I'll be interested to pose it to people in those communities, you know, what's it like right now? How much drilling? The U.S. is already at record levels of oil production. What does more drilling mean? Is it so easy to drill? Do people want to see more drilling? What will that do to the price of gas and among other things? So I'm keen to get an understanding and go in, hopefully not with a lot of preconceived notions, and ask the questions and see what, you know, it's my job. And Debbie Elliott, for the Southern correspondent, I'm the Western correspondent. She covers the American South. I'm the American West. We want to see what's the mood is on the ground and tell the, you know, from the people on the ground, not necessarily the policymakers in Washington or the think tanks, the people on the ground, see what they think. And we'll be telling stories around them and narratives around what they think going forward. So yeah, stay tuned. Could be one of those states or all three of those states.
All right.
We'll see.
We'll look forward to that. Kirk Siegler, appreciate your reporting and appreciate you taking a bit of time today. Thanks.
Glad to be here, and please support Utah Public Radio. It's a valuable community resource, and your contribution covers everything from the show that we're talking on to my reporting and my colleagues reporting in the field, bringing you the stories that you count on, and hopefully bringing a little joy to the process, too.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. All right. Bye-bye. We've been talking with Kirk Siegler. He's a national correspondent for National Public Radio. And so we appreciate him a lot. As we head toward a break, just a reminder to join your support with those who've already participated. Join your support with Kirk Siegler's and the great work that he does. And support the great work that that he does and many other reporters. And, of course, the local reporting as well. Just by going to upr.org. upr.org is the place to go, upr.org. Or you can call 800-826-1495. You may have heard about maybe some threats to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the federal support that we receive. We don't know what's going to happen with that. A lot of uncertainty there, but that's about 10 to 15% of our budget. So if that went away tomorrow, that would hurt. Can't deny that. But the comforting fact to me is that it is only 10 to 15% of the budget. We do receive some support and much appreciated from Utah State University. But 50% of the budget is directly from community support. And you're the biggest part of that. So that is something that we can control. And that is a comforting thought to me. I hope to you as well. And we hope that you will take a moment and give your support at whatever level. 800-826-1495, upr.org, upr.org. We have some great thank you gifts as well. We have the UPR art mug is available. It's beautiful, a Bear Lake scene. That's the latest one. Add that to your collection or start your collection of UPR mugs. upr.org is the place to go, and thank you.